Hey, listener, Zach Harper here. Underdog Fantasy, the easiest place to play fantasy sports. Also, fastest growing fantasy app in the industry. Here's how it works. The Pick'em game. Pick whether your favorite players will have a higher or lower stat total in this week's game for a chance to win big. How big, you ask? I'm so glad you asked that question, listener. You can win up to 100 times your money in a single night. Pick between 2 and 5 players, build a pick'em entry. You can also do rivals picks. You can put like Tyrese Halliburton and Jalen Brunson against each other, and whoever has more points, more assists, more rebounds, whatever you want to do, that is your rivals pick. I would maybe go with Jalen Brunson in these playoffs. By the way, in the regular season, Jalen Brunson, scoring tear, going higher on his point totals all the time. Joel Embiid, whenever he did actually play, higher on his scoring totals all the time. Victor Wembanyama, for the next 15, 20 years, here's a pro tip for you, take higher on the blocks. That's right. So you're probably wondering, how do you sign up? Oh my God, listener, you are full of good questions today. Sign up with the promo code DING, that's D-I-N-G, to claim your special pick first time deposit offer up to $250 in bonus cash. $250, man, that's a lot. Visit underdogfantasy.com or find them in the app store. And don't forget to register with our code DING, D-I-N-G, to claim your special pick and first time deposit offer up to $250 in bonus cash. Must be 18 or older, 21 or older in Massachusetts, Arizona, 19 or older in Alabama and Nebraska, and present in a state where Underdog Fantasy operates. Terms apply. Concerned with your play, call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.ncpgambling.org. Arizona 1-800-NEXT-STEP. That's 1-800-639-8783. Or text next step to 53342. New York, call the 24/7 Hope line at 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the latest edition of the Woke Bros. Of course, I'm your co-host, Big Waz, a.k.a. Wosni Lambre. Joined as always by my comrade, man, my brother, my partner for real, like the Wayans, Nando Vila out there on the west side of Los Angeles. Nando, what's up with you, brother?
Doing well. How you doing?
I'm good. As always, we got Rob Lopez on the ones and threes, keeping the trains running on time. On today's show, we figured since it's the holidays, we wanted to get sentimental and sort of get into how and why it is we got into doing what we do, right? As far as our own political awakenings, how we became the people who became these dirty, rotten, scoundrel hippies that bring you this show every single week. Nando has a really fucking cool story. You know, whatever. I can get into mine. I just think it would be dope to share with you guys. And I would love for you guys to hit us up and talk about your own influences and how you got into it. Because I know, you know, rest in peace, my brother Michael Brooks, when he passed away, so many messages I got were from people who were like, look, man, I fucked with you off the NBA shit. You know, I was like, this guy's entertaining in NBA. I'll listen to his fucking politics show with Mike. And Mike completely radicalized these folks, you know. It's just amazing that it was really touching to get those messages from people, because that's what we were trying to do. You know, and that's what we continue to try to do, is just to wake people up to the things that, you know, that we all care about, right? And so we'll get into that towards the end of the show. But first, Nando, yesterday, man, we're taping this on a Wednesday afternoon. Yesterday was Tuesday afternoon. Your president, Donald J. Trump, got in a press conference, and it's so crazy. You know what it reminded me of, Nando? The Republican primary in 2016.
Yeah.
It was Trump.
That old magic. That old Trump magic.
It was Trump giving you real talk that goes anti every single thing his party stands for. Like he was just cutting it down. Like when he would talk about, how'd your brother keep us safe if 9/11 happened when it happened?
Yeah.
Iraq sucked. Yeah. We're still in Afghanistan. Blah, blah, blah. Like,
Bush lied and people died.
Yeah.
He said that in a debate to Jeb Bush.
He said that to Jeb Bush's face, right? Yeah. Like, because that's a little party. Like, my brother kept us safe after 9/11. It's like this weird thing. It's like, it's this weird thing.
Yeah, we're not counting 9/11.
Right. It's like, you telling a chick, I kept you safe after I raped you. It's like, what?
Yeah. Oh, I didn't cheat on you after that first time.
Right. It's like, what are you talking about? Anyway, he goes up there, Nando, and he's like, this bill stinks. You know, like they filled it up with all kinds of pork for all kinds of interests that have nothing to do with COVID. And I hate it. And if we were really doing something right, we'd be giving the people $2,000. $600 isn't enough. That's a pittance. We need to give the people $2,000. And online Twitter blew up. It just erupted. Even my normie group chats were like, yo, wow, the president just got up there and gave us some real talk. That's freaking crazy, Nando.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, you know, I think what happened, and it happened to me a little bit, is that I forgot Trump was the president. Like, I just forgot that he was the president just because he's been, like, in this MIA. Insane. Yeah, MIA, just, like, focused on, like, overturning the state legislatures, electors in the state of Pennsylvania. You know, like, insanely down this rabbit hole of trying to overturn the election. And, like, no one's paying attention to him outside of, like, OANN and, like, the most insane MAGA people. So I just kind of forgot that he was the president. And as this whole drama was going on between the negotiations for the stimulus bill, which we've been covering pretty regularly on the show, forgot one small little detail, which is that the president,
right?
Yeah, Trump, the president has to sign the bill. We just forgot about that because he's off doing whatever the fuck he's doing. And he just came out and reminded him, he's like, You guys, you haven't gotten rid of me yet. Haven't gotten rid of me yet. Still gotta sign this bitch, and I don't want to sign it. You know, after like, you know, months of negotiations and all that stuff. And like, listen, let's be clear: the bill that was agreed upon and the bill that passed the House, which was going to pass the Senate and was going to go to Trump's desk, is dog shit. Like, it's dog shit. It is. You know, I suppose you could eat, like, if you're starving to death, you could eat some dog shit and it might help you survive like a little bit longer, you know, than you would if you were just dying of thirst and hunger in the middle of the desert. But it's dog shit. Like, it is the bare minimum to keep this country afloat before the vaccine really kind of gets distributed widely and we kind of get past this shit. It's another just grotesque handout to the wealthy, like, just, you know, pittance for everyone. It's $600, which is, you know, we were laughing at the $1,200 and how little that felt in back in the summer, and now they're cutting that in half.
As the unemployment are worse insurance than they were, things are not better than they were, things are worse.
People have been suffering through this pandemic. I mean, 50 million Americans are experiencing hunger. I mean, it's crazy. And then the unemployment insurance, which was the thing in the first bill that really kept a lot of people afloat, the expanded $600 a week in unemployment insurance, that was also cut in half to $300. And, you know, they had to do something because that unemployment insurance, just in general unemployment insurance, is expiring at the end of the year. It's expiring in 3 days or something like that. And you know, they have to do the reason why it passed now and not earlier is because they had to attach it to what they call an omnibus spending bill, which is basically the bill which funds the government for the next year. Right. So they use that excuse to attach the coronavirus relief package to that because they have to pass that bill in some way, shape or form, which is why it came down to the wire and why all this shit got added. Like, I mean, there was a provision in there that gave you a tax break if you had a fucking racehorse. Of course, Mitch McConnell is a senator from Kentucky, where they have all the racehorses. And you get a tax break if you have a fucking racehorse. Like, it's just, there's so many grotesque things about this. And that's like a tiny little piece of it. Right. I mean, there's $500 million in aid to Israel.
Just because.
You know, like, just part of the coronavirus relief package. Yeah, what? You know, so.
In his press conference, Trump did this surreal thing where he's literally reading it off. And it is something that jolts you when you hear the numbers, when you hear how expensive some of this stuff is. What got it to 900 million was not we're pouring 900 billion, excuse me, into you guys, our citizenry, the people who need this, the people who are suffering. We're, you know, it got to 900 billion just because we're just handing shit out to our friends. It's,
oh yeah.
Wow.
I mean, so the bill was 5,000 pages long. I mean, AOC was tweeting about this yesterday. She, like, there was a picture of the bill. It's like, I mean, it's it's like the size of, I don't know, five dictionaries stacked on top of each other. And so like no one had a chance to read it before they were forced to vote on it. And like the New York Times kind of dug into it. And this is their this is their opening two paragraphs. OK, just in their analysis of the bill. This is the New York Times. This is not some far left thing. This is like unbelievably mainstream. It writes, tucked away in the 5,593-page spending bill that Congress rushed through on Monday night as a provision is a provision that some tax experts call a $200 billion giveaway to the rich. It involves the tens of thousands of businesses that received loans from the federal government this spring with the promise that the loans would be forgiven tax-free if they agreed to keep employees on the payroll through the coronavirus pandemic. But basically, it's this like PPP provision of which they say 1% of the businesses that got PPP got a quarter of the PPP, meaning like it's the most powerful businesses that were able to like maneuver the system, mm-hmm. kind of just got this giant, giant giveaway to them, you know? And so that's just, it just shows just how shit works in Washington. It's like the rich have to be made whole and then whatever crumbs are left over go to you and I. And this bill is like a particularly grotesque version of it, but Trump has just thrown all that into disarray because by threatening to veto it, he's opening the door. Like he basically handed the Democrats a giant gift.
Yes.
Like a giant gift. If the Democrats play this right, this is like an enormous gift, right? Because the only reason why McConnell passed anything at all was to try to save the careers of Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue in Georgia. He knew that he needed to pass something so that they could survive this this January 5th election and he can keep control of the Senate. But he wanted to keep it as low as possible, as little as possible, just the bare minimum. Now, with Trump threatening a veto, if the Democrats were to pass a new bill in the House that satisfied a $2,000 check and put it on McConnell's desk, knowing that Trump has already supported it publicly and that John Ossoff, the candidate in Georgia, has supported the $2,000 publicly, he's putting them in a position in which McConnell has to either block it and he has to get Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue on record saying they oppose the $2,000 checks, or he's got to pass it. Like he's in an impossible position. That's if, this is a big if, the Democrats play this right.
Right. And so I want to talk about a couple of things, Nando. First, immediately, of course, afterwards, Chuck Schumer, who has recanted since, has changed his tune about it, was like, what's Trump doing? Well, why don't we just pass the thing we just negotiated and then we'll come back to the 2000?
Yeah.
Idiot. No, idiot. What are you talking? Why would you say that? Okay, yeah. Cool. Then, of course, I see Amy Klobuchar on your liberal and MSNBC with Rachel Maddow talking about, I mean, he's just throwing a temper tantrum. We negotiated this thing and blah, 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 blah. We talked about it in our little woke bros chat. And I'm like, Nando, like, what are we doing? What's happening? Why are these idiot centrist Dems doing this? And Nando, could you explain to the people why it is these idiot Dems wouldn't do the Pelosi thing, which is just like, fuck, I didn't fucking negotiate that damn deal. I'm for the 2000 immediately. And why those idiots were so slow to understand what was actually happening to them.
Yeah, because it was interesting. You would think like they're all on the same team and they would all be unified in their messaging. Pelosi came out immediately like was like, yeah, $2,000, let's do it. Whereas the Senate Democrats were not. And that's because there's a big difference between the Senate and the House. We kind of vaguely think of it as the same shit, you know, right. They're just kind of out there in Washington, and, you know, but the Senate is very different from the House. The Senate is a very strange institution.
It's a club.
In the Senate, it's a club. They feel like they're part of a club. Like they feel more in common with each other than they do with members of their own party that are in the House. Yep. You know, that's why you see things like Dianne Feinstein hugging Lindsey Graham at the Judiciary Committee. They're like friends. That's why they all like talk about like John McCain as if he were a saint in heaven.
He was St. Francis of Assisi.
Yeah, exactly. And they see those House people as like rabble rousers. You know, even though the house is more more reflective of
the people,
of the people, you know, by its very composition, the Senate is just this, like, they all hang out like in the Senate cloakroom and like
here's smoking where, cigars and drinking whiskey.
Yeah. Exactly. They see themselves as part of the club, and they were like, no. This is the deal we negotiated. Yeah. This is the deal.
The club came up with a deal. Me and my homies, we ironed this out together. We did kumbaya together and got a deal. What's wrong with you people?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, and Joe Biden, remember, Joe Biden was a senator since the 1970s, since the early 1970s. He was a senator since he's like his early 30s. He's been a senator his whole life, pretty much. So he very much believes in all that stuff, which is why Joe Biden intervened to get this bill accepted by the Senate Democrats, which is interesting. Also, the other interesting wrinkle about this whole deal is that Kamala Harris, who also is still technically in the Senate, Kamala Harris wrote a bill with Bernie Sanders and Ed Markey a few months ago before she was vice president or vice presidential nominee. Or no, before she was vice, I don't remember if it was before she was vice president or vice presidential nominee, calling for $2,000 checks a month to everyone.
Right.
She's now the vice president-elect and is still in the Senate. And Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have said nothing about the coronavirus relief package. Nothing. Like some vague things here and there. Like, yes, we need something. But they haven't like weighed in heavily on any of this shit. Which is just, again, it just shows just how reluctant Democratic leadership is to do the bold things that are necessary to save this country, quite frankly, you know?
It's sad, but you're right. And also, Nando, what I wanted to bring to your attention, because driving home just now, my lady asked me, she said, why would anybody be against $2,000 checks for people during this fucking, why would they be against the pandemic? And I'm like, well, my only guess, honestly, is they don't want people to think that this is routine, that this is normal. Yeah. They don't want to be held to this standard ever.
Oh, yeah. Because
you do that, then people say, hold on, the government can, like, do just shit
give you
for
money?
Me.
Just give you money?
Yeah, like, they don't want people, they have conditioned people to think that you're a piece of shit to take a government handout, that you're lazy, that you're a bum, that you don't like to work, that you're shiftless, that only those people do welfare, And you ask yourself, well, obviously I can understand why the Republicans are doing it, but why the Democrats? Again, they're beholden to the exact same corporate interests who are like, look, if those people start wanting to get their share of the pie, how are we going to take everything? How are we going to keep everything for ourselves? It's obvious why Dems aren't behind it. It's just obvious.
You're exactly right that it's a disciplinary function. It's they need to keep people conditioned. They need people that are willing to go break their backs at an Amazon fulfillment center. You know, they need people to like demean themselves and, you know, drive for, I don't know, Lyft and Postmates and all these things, you know, like they need people that are willing to do these kind of bullshit, awful jobs because that's how the system runs. If they sort of raise people's expectations, then the whole thing kind of changes dramatically and they don't want that, you know?
Right.
So if they start to realize that the government can actually provide relief for people and that people can exercise their democratic rights to redistribute wealth to themselves rather than just redistributing it upwards to the rich, that's a very powerful example that they don't want to give to people. I mean, Trump and the Republicans did better than expected in the election. Why? Because they put money in people's pockets. Like at the end of the day, if this bill were to pass, the $600 relief package, most people will just remember that Trump gave me $1,200 and Biden gave me $600. Yeah, and that's it. Like Trump and the Republicans did better than expected because they provided people with welfare in some degree in the CARES package. I mean, it was gross and awful the way that bill was structured. It was trillions of dollars to the rich, but it did give people, put money in people's pockets. And as much as like $30,000 for some people because of the unemployment insurance. So yeah, I mean, that's why he did better than expected. It's why he did better with like immigrant communities everywhere in America. It's why he did better with Latinos in South Texas. I mean, it was all that. I mean, at the end of the day, money talks, and all the cultural issues we fight about every single day matter way less than that.
And to the extent that they do matter, they matter in the absence of that, right? Like when there is, when that's not on the table in any significant
way. We got to fight about something else. Yeah,
exactly. That's what we'll end up doing. And so, you know, that's, again, when at the top of the show, Nando talks about a horse owner subsidy. That's literally money that belonged to the government that they just said now belongs to those horse owners. That's what's happening. It's a welfare check, period. That's what it is. It's money that they would have otherwise had to give to the government, put in the tax coffers, that the government said, nah, I'm going to give it back to you.
Yeah.
That's what happened. That's what happened. Nobody would sit around and call those people lazy, you know, shiftless and all of this kind of stuff. It never happens. These people take the wealthiest people take government giveaways. They take money from the government all the time.
All the time.
All the time. It's like
amounts of money that would shock most people.
That would shock people. And again, the only person that was framing it that way was your friend Bernie Sanders. Yeah. And that's not by accident. The Dems are not your friends, guys. They are not your friends. There's a reason why one thing gets framed as, you know, welfare and what's the other word they like to use? Entitlements.
Yeah.
One thing gets framed that way, and the other thing gets nice words like, oh, it's a subsidy. It's a tax break. It's welfare, you motherfucker. And so, man, we're taping this on a Wednesday afternoon. This thing is still being negotiated again. Donald Trump, and we can't really know what his motivations are. I've heard like it's like when I come back in 2024, the people are gonna love me. You know.
So, like right as we started taping, Trump vetoed something called the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, which is the bill that funds the military. So Congress had gone home for Christmas, Christmas vacation. Now they're being forced to come back because Trump vetoed the military spending bill for next year. And you know, they have to come back and override the veto.
They have to do that.
They're going to do that.
That's, you know, number like, one. That's your number one job.
Oh, yeah. They will leave their half-eaten pancakes on Christmas morning to fly back to Washington to override the veto on the military spending bill. But the fact is they have to come back. So this gives the Democrats an opportunity to pass a new bill with the $2,000 check and put it on McConnell's desk and see what he does with it. I mean, it just seems such an obvious political move. Don't bet on the Dems to do it. There's definitely momentum behind it. You see Cory Booker has come out in favor of it. John Ossoff has come in favor of it. Obviously, Bernie Sanders, you know, has come out in favor of it. There is some momentum to it. But it all, the way the House and the Senate are structured, it all matters. The leadership is what really matters. And so we'll see what Pelosi does. But yeah, I mean, it was crazy. Nobody expected it, you know.
That, this Trump is the Trump
at the 11th hour. Yeah,
the December surprise. That dude is the gift that keeps on giving. And so, man, guys, just keep your eye on that during the holiday. I guess I don't even know what else to say.
Yeah.
Is there something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals? I know I've been through it. I've had problems at work, problems in relationships. You know, even problems as a parent. Sometimes you don't know where to turn to or who to talk to, particularly when you don't want to talk to someone who knows you, who might have a bias or might hold what you're going to say against you. You want to talk to someone who's experienced and licensed and at the same time distant and removed from you. BetterHelp is here to help. They'll assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can start communicating in under 48 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. This is professional counseling done securely online. There's a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas. The service is available for clients worldwide. I know many of our listeners are listening to us from other countries, whether it's Canada, Australia, somewhere in Europe, somewhere in Asia, or somewhere in Africa. Look, you guys can access this as well. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available for those who need it. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. Visit their website. Read the testimonials. They're posted daily. For instance, this one from user NU after counseling with Denise Wall Marlin for 2 years on issues concerning depression, stress, anxiety, and self-esteem. Quote, I have found Denise to be an excellent counselor. She has broad experience in all techniques to get rid of anxiety and ruminating thoughts and always puts things in perspective for me. I recommend her 100%. Hell, I hear that one. I want to sign up with Denise because I know ruminating thoughts and anxiety is something I deal with all the time. So here's what you can do, and I'll do it too. Visit BetterHelp.com/BOM. That's Better H-E-L-P. And join the over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. It's a special offer going right now for our listeners here on BOM. Get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/BOM. That's BetterHelp.com/BOM.
Moving on, and, you know, I love to give credit where credit's due, and Nando is the one that brought this to my attention as an idea. We did want to talk about just sort of our own political journeys and awakenings, and how did we find ourselves becoming, you know, these dirty centrist cats. I mean, excuse me, dirty.
What? Excuse me. Don't insult me like that. I may be dirty, but I ain't no centrist.
I ain't no centrist. And I've told the story a couple of times, but I think it bears repeating, right? I definitely didn't start following politics in any, like, even tangential way until Barack Obama, right? Mm. Like, his candidacy, his campaign definitely lit my imagination on fire. Just the idea that this black dude could seemingly come out of nowhere. Yeah. And not that he can't, because, you know, we learned that he didn't come out of nowhere. Like, we learned that he curried favor amongst the elite class for years, like, to get his little donor base right. He made the right connections with his Harvard people and all of that. He knew what he was doing. Like, he was fucking genius at that. Let's not get that twisted. But it seemed like he came out of nowhere. Like, he wasn't Colin Powell, who we all had heard of. You know what I'm saying? Like, as a political figure. And for him to, you know, to take the presidency as an underdog, specifically against Hillary Clinton and that machine within the party, it was like, wow. Like, and the campaign was about something. It was about change and hope and, you know, all this other shit. And it was like, wow, this is, politics can be powerful. And I sort of became addicted after that, right? And not addicted, I shouldn't say that. I just was like, wow, I'm really following this. And then, so I want to fast forward. I got this job at a bank, and I want to say 2011. In 2011. And, you know, I had this desk job where I'm just literally fucking at a desk all day, every day, reading a computer. And this is also around the same time that Bill Simmons dropped Grantland. And anybody who knows this remembers Grantland, what they were known for were these fucking long-ass articles.
Yeah.
Like, they were just known for long-form shit, which I liked at my job because it passed the time. Like, I would be on Grantland every single day hoping they had some shit that I could pass the time with. And one of the people who I became a huge fan of was Charlie Pierce.
Yeah.
Because he's just an incredible writer. Like, not even his takes, just like, he's just poetic. Like, this dude is a poet, right? And I became a fan of his. And then I realized that he had this other job that he's been had at Esquire as basically their political correspondent. So he was double dipping. He was doing sports with Grantland and politics with Esquire. And so I started reading this political shit. And, you know, he's a Massachusetts guy. He's a fucking, He's a Wisconsin guy because he went to Marquette. And a lot of people don't know Wisconsin is like historically known for a lot of progressivism. Like the La Follette dude, like he started a whole bunch of shit. Like it used to be this like progressive hotbed. It's not anymore. Like it's Scott Walker and the Cokes and all of that. But like Wisconsin is known for a lot of that shit, especially within academia. And like Charles Pierce definitely put me on to mad people, right? Like I remember the first time I read Ed Kilgore, or the first time I read David Dayan, or the first time, like he would always link to all of these people that were also blogging about politics. And so, you know, I just started getting my awareness up about certain things more and more and more and more and more. And then Charles Pierce wrote a blog post about this little show called Up with Chris Hayes. Nando, you're going to love this shit. So
On Saturday morning.
And Charles Pierce is like, you know what I fucking love this show? It's not like the goddamn Sunday shows where they have these DC hacks all the time. Chris Hayes got community activists up there. It's not academic. He got like people who work in the actual communities, union leaders. Like this shit is revolutionary on MSNBC. It's this little show on Saturday mornings. You should watch it. So I then become a fan of Up with Chris Hayes, and I'm watching Hayes all the time. And one day I see a guy named Sam Cedar on there. And Sam Cedar, of course, on MSNBC's airwaves is a flamethrower.
Radical.
He's a psychopath, right? And I'm like, shit, I got to start fucking with Sam Cedar. And I start watching the Majority Report. And I start, you know, paying attention to what Sam Cedar is doing on them. And then I start watching Sam Cedar, and he has, like, his co-host, and he has the producer, whatever. But his co-host, a guy named Michael Brooks, he doesn't really talk much. Like, he adds in his little jokes. He does his little things. But it's Sam's show, right? Like,
he's like Paul Schaefer for Letterman.
Right, exactly. But every Monday, Sam would let Michael do his own show. That was basically Sam's days off. And that was called Michael Mondays. And so, I'm not going to lie, Nando, at first, I'm like, I'm not going to watch Sam's sidekick run the show. I'm not watching this shit. And I ignored Michael Mondays. Then finally, I watched a Michael Monday. And I was like, yo, this motherfucker's incredible. He's a fucking, he's a riot. He's great. And I always start watching Michael Mondays with Michael Brooks. And one day, as I tell the story all the time, he made his Barack Obama as a Nation of Islam radical. He did it that little bit, which I thought was genius. I reached out to him. He was like, yo, what's up? I actually live in Brooklyn, blah, 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 blah. We got lunch and all of that. And we became friends, and our friendship just did nothing but grow from there. Which is to say that, like, as all of these things are happening, I'm becoming less and less, oh, I just fuck with the Dems like my parents and my whole family does.
Charlie Pierce does. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Progressively becoming like, man, and you know what I will say about Charles Pierce? From the beginning, he was very skeptical of Barry's pie in the sky, no red America, blue America. He's like, that shit don't make no damn sense. That's not how this works. The Republicans gonna clean his clock, all of that shit, whatever. Anyway, but yeah, progressively, I'm becoming more and more radicalized because I'm just like, as I start consuming the stuff that isn't what you get on New York Times, it starts resonating with me more and more and more and more to now where I get to the point where I'm at now, right? Like, where I'm just, when my normie friends are talking, I feel like they're watching a different politics than me. Yeah. You understand what I'm saying? So that's basically how I got here. And of course, as y'all know, I met Nando through Mike, right? And now me and Nando have become friends, and we're growing our relationship in a beautiful way. And I just wanted to share that with y'all. Like, I'm so happy people listen to what we do and get something out of it. Because that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to change some minds one person at a time. We're trying to indoctrinate some people one person at a time, Nando.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's definitely part of our mission, right? And we try to be accessible. We try to be fun. We don't try to be preachy in any way, and we don't try to be like judgmental, you know, if you have like the bad takes or whatever. No, we try to be welcoming. We're welcoming people on this show. And you know, if you're kind of left curious but think it's a little bit scary to understand the ins and outs, like, you know, we're here to help. My political trajectory started a little earlier. I've been on the left, quote unquote, basically since my early years in college. I was already kind of by like 2006, 2007, I was pretty disillusioned with the Democratic Party, especially the wake of the Kerry campaign. You know, I voted for Kerry and was kind of very aware of what was going on, but I was just, you know, I was like, how could they let Bush, just such an obvious criminal and such an obvious dumbass at the same time, beat them? Like, you know? And I remember, like, when I was in high school, I was always kind of very interested in world affairs. My parents are from Spain, and I would travel to Europe a lot when I was a kid to visit family and things like that. And so I always had kind of like this worldly air, and that I kind of cultivated because I was a snot-nosed fucking dumbass when I was a young kid. But it is true that I was kind of like, I was kind of interested in what was going on in the world outside of the United States and things like that. And then when the Iraq War happened, I was a senior in high school. I graduated high school in 2004. So 2003, I was junior, senior year in high school. I remember that summer of 2003, which, if people don't remember, people too young to remember that time, it was fucking crazy. Like, it was crazy. The 2 years after 9/11 were insane in America. I mean, it was like fully fascist. I mean, in terms of the media just falling in lockstep with whatever the government said.
Yeah, they call people traitors for not being behind the Iraq, like traitors. Yeah. Like you're plotting against your country for not
backing. Phil Donahue was a host on MSNBC at the time. Phil Donahue on MSNBC, he was a host, and he started asking questions about the Iraq War and, you know, none of this makes a lot of sense. And like, he wasn't like a flamethrower or anything. No. He was fired, and he's never
Phil
come back.
Phil Donahue, bro. Yeah.
He was fired from MSNBC and never came back. The Dixie Chicks. Do you remember that whole controversy?
Of course.
Like, it was just crazy, a crazy, crazy time where the New York, everyone from Fox News, obviously, to the New York Times was marching in lockstep with the Bush administration on their march to Iraq. And I was just a kid in high school, and I kind of got more or less wrapped into it. Not like I wasn't like some fire breathing war rah rah guy, but I was like, yeah, you know, this is like the right, this is more or less like, yeah, we should do that. Like,
so the listeners can know, I too was in high school in 03. I would have been probably a junior, I guess, because the summer of 03 would have been right before my junior year.
Yeah.
So
I'm a grade older than you. Yeah.
In between sophomore and junior year. And I will say, especially having been in New York, lived in New York when 9/11 happened, right, and had the shit scared out of you. The idea that we would try to bust some skulls behind it, that wasn't even a question. Yeah. That wasn't even like questioning that.
Someone
I remember my crazy Uncle Gene, who was always a politics dork, and I'd be like, I mean, he'd be like, because my nickname, my family members call me Whoa. And he's like, Whoa, you think we should go to Afghanistan? I'm like, we got to get Bin Laden, right? And he goes to me. And for years afterwards, he would make fun of me and say, we got to get Bin Laden, right? he would make fun of me for, I think, 5 years afterwards. Like, right, this fucking idiot drinking the Kool-Aid. Anyway, continue, Nando.
Yeah. I mean, it's always worth remembering, Barbara Lee, the only congressperson to vote against the Afghanistan war. The only person
that's insane
to vote against it.
Could you
crazy
think, like,
3 days after 9/11,
could you think about one thing that we could get not get more people to vote against these? They're like, what could actually be on the ballot? I just saw somewhere that they like just ended slavery in Utah. You know what I'm saying? Like, which shows you that there were people who were like, nah, I don't think so. That would have like not unanimously done it. Like, that's insane, dude. That's insane.
So, I mean, so I was like more or less kind of going along with the whole thing just because like every like the media climate at the time was crazy and the political climate and everything, the social climate, everyone was like, yeah, I mean, look, they took down the towers and now they got to pay. And, you know, even though Iraq had nothing to do with it, literally nothing to do with it, like it's just completely, you know, just completely
like even the types of thing. The types of Muslims who did 9/11, like they don't have anything. If anything, they'd be antagonists. They'd be antagonistic. Yeah. Like these people have been beefing for years.
Yeah. So I remember I went to Spain that summer of 2003, as I did basically every summer. And, you know, I was like 17 years old and it was like that kind of age where people started talking about politics a lot more. And in Spain, the Iraq war was very controversial because the Spanish prime minister was one of the few European heads of state to really go in lockstep with Bush on the war. It was Bush, Blair, and Aznar, who was the head of the Spanish government at the time. And so it was very controversial in Spain. I mean, Spain was incredibly divided on it and young people were all against it. And so I remember going there and like all my Spanish friends were like, oh, you know, Bush, you fucking, you know, criminal and like the Iraq. And I was like, I had like an almost like a natural reaction to be whoa. Like, shut up.
America's
like,
great.
Yeah, what are you talking about? Like, you guys are just jealous. And but then, you know, the more I stayed there that summer, you started seeing news reports coming from Iraq and the Spanish media. The Spanish television, just like this television pretty much everywhere in the world outside of the United States, doesn't censor violence in the news. In the United States, you cannot show on a newscast in, you know, CBS Evening News dead bodies on the street. You can't even show casket. You couldn't even show at the time there was like a whole political thing. You couldn't even show the caskets. You couldn't show
American bodies coming back.
Yeah. You couldn't even show the caskets of the bodies coming back. So the war was just kind of like a fake video game or something. Mm-hmm. Like you didn't see the violent effects of it, which were like unbelievably grim, if you cared to look. And you know, we've seen subsequently a lot of the images that have come out and things like that are horrifying. And I remember being just like watching a Spanish newscast, which is like a regular newscast. It wasn't even like a breaking news. It was just like the regular kind of newscast. There's just some reporter out in Iraq covering the war, and it's like you start to see like horrific violence. You start to see like, you know, a child's hand kind of severed on laying there in the middle of the street, or, you know, just dead bodies everywhere. And the violence of the war and the sort of difference in the media culture that I saw was so jarring that it put the seed in my mind that something was deeply, deeply wrong with this whole thing. And then when I got to college, I studied history, and I remember I had a professor who was just like a, you know, basically liberal, not particularly radical.
Where did you go to college? Do people want to know?
Boston College. I went to Boston College Eagle, BC.
Wow.
Baby. Yeah. I went to college with Matt Ryan. Yeah.
Oh, same okay. Class got as Matt you. Ryan. Got you. Matty Ice days. Okay,
Matty Ice, baby. Yeah. And Jared Dudley, you know, NBA fans. Of course. Yeah. And you know, I had, you know, Boston College is not a radical school at all. It's a pretty conservative school, actually. It's a Jesuit school. You know, they didn't allow gay clubs, for example, when we were there. And so we had this professor who was just kind of a standard lib, and he taught American foreign policy. And I just learned about American foreign policy, and I was just like, wait, we killed 3 million people in Vietnam? Like, we always hear about the 57,000 Americans that died in the Vietnam War because there's a Vietnam War Memorial. We killed 3 million people? What? You know, like, what? For what? No reason. The fucking Vietnam, like, a country that has nothing to do with anything. Just
communism.
For no reason. Yeah, for no reason. I'm like, what? And, you know, that's when I started kind of reading a lot more dissenting voices. And then obviously I started reading Noam Chomsky, which I recommend everyone to read, or watch him on YouTube or watch his documentary. There's a documentary that was on Netflix. I don't know if it's still on Netflix. It might still be on Netflix, but it's definitely on YouTube, called A Requiem for an American Dream, but hosted by Noam Chomsky. Highly recommend it. Highly recommend Manufacturing Consent, which is a book and a documentary. Anyway, when you read Chomsky, you realize that, like, oh my God, all of this, all of the stuff that we were indoctrinated with is
bullshit.
All a lie. Bullshit. Like, it's just straight up propaganda and bullshit. And so, yeah, that was when I started kind of becoming more of like what I would call like a leftist. You know, I started getting interested in the history of socialism. And once you realize, once you've shed this sort of propaganda
about capitalism, about how
America,
you can't have freedom without capitalism. Like, exactly. Like, they tie everything that America is, this idea of freedom, individual freedom and democracy and all of that. We only have it but for the free market.
Yeah, to the profit motive.
Yeah. We could funny not how that have
works.
Those
funny
things.
How that works. Yeah. Funny how
it's,
that works.
It's the most genius marketing plan that ever was devised. It was like, oh, we cannot have those things without the profit motive.
No. And you're right that it was a explicit marketing plan. I mean, there's everyone should look up Adam Curtis's documentaries. A lot of them are on YouTube. If not, seek them out on wherever you can. Adam Curtis, he's done a documentary called Hypernormalization, which kind of explains pretty much everything about the current moment. He did a documentary called Bitter Lake, which explains the U.S. relationship to Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan over the years, which is fucking fascinating. And then he did a documentary about a guy named Eddie Bernays, who was Sigmund Freud's nephew or something like that. And he was the guy who basically created that propaganda plan that you're talking about, using psychoanalysis to basically sell capitalism to the American people. It's a fascinating documentary. Anyway, that's when I started reading all about that stuff. And then when Obama came along, I was living in China. I moved to China after I graduated college. And when Obama came along, I was like, wait a minute, this is different.
This is not Kerry. Yeah,
this is not John Kerry. This is not fucking Hillary Clinton. This is something else. I mean, you know, he's running on closing Guantanamo Bay and, you know, some of these horrific crimes that he spoke very eloquently about all that stuff. And then he got in there and within 0.05 seconds, and when he started appointing all the bank executives to run his economic team, I was like, okay, all of them were right. All of those like left critics who I was like kind of wary of, like, come on, it's Obama. Like, what are you? Like, they were all
right.
100% right. That, like, you know, the corporations, man, they control the government, man. You know, like, and it's like, yeah. I mean, how can you deny it? Yeah.
And that's where we get to today, right? And you know, Barry looms large on this podcast because I think when we had that conversation on our newest segment, maybe Obama's kind of a douche, on our newest segment. And what I think the most important thing you said, Nando, is that, like, no, like, Barry is thoughtful. Barry is smart. Barry does, like,
he's better than think these about people.
Like, he isn't this at the hip type of guy. Like, he is a deep thinker. Like, he should know better. Like, Barry, of all, like, that's, we would expect the most from him. Somebody as eloquent as him.
Barry grew up in Indonesia shortly after a U.S.-sponsored genocide that killed 1 million people. He's written about this.
Right.
You know? Like, in Dreams of My Father, you know? Like, they lived in Indonesia shortly after this. Like, he really should know better. He really should know better. I mean, there's a book called The Jakarta Method, which I read this year by Vincent Bevins, which talks about the Indonesian genocide, which the United States was actively involved in. 1 million people wiped off the face of the earth, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And, you know, while we're recommending books related to my own radicalism, too, I read, I think his name is Timothy Weiner, or I forget his name, but he wrote this book called Legacy of Ashes. And it's about the history of the CIA. Ooh. And the book is based on the official records. you know, like 30 years after they fuck up a mission in Cambodia, they declassify it. And so the book is just about the shit they let us know publicly. And that's basically what Legacy of Ashes is about. And what he systematically shows you throughout the course of the book is that the CIA is trash, has been trash, and will always be trash. They have been terrible at their stated job from the inception. From the start, they stunk up the joint. They get a lot of money and funding. And so with money, you can do anything, right? Like, you can wield influence in third world countries, and you can start coups, and you can do that because you have money. But, like, just as tactics and, like, this idea, like, you know, when you watch Jason Bourne, that's how I know it's propaganda. That's why, like, I have trouble with conspiracy theorists now, because I'm like, bro, I think it's the opposite. I think if the CIA were actually Jason Bourne, they wouldn't have to put it in a movie. Like, that's just propagandizing us to think that these guys are these hyper-competent superhumans. No. They are bumbling idiots, and if they didn't have the might of the American government, military, and money behind them, they would have been fired a long time ago, right? Like, Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs. Like, the Bay of Pigs is, that's CIA.
That's the most half-baked insane plot. Thing that's, like, ever happened,
Right, it's like a half-baked plot. It's like, we got some money, we could pay some people to do it. We just praying that it's gonna work. It serves the need of a perceived agenda that we think the power wants. So they're like suckling at the power teeth, like, no, we're gonna get it done for you. And they fail time after time after time. And then when you really learn about why we went to Vietnam, when it's just like, what? Like, they think communism is going to spread in Asia, and then from Asia is just going to jump over the seas and get America. It's like, what? Containment? Yeah. What? These are our geniuses. And so, you know, it's along the way you read all of these things and you learn all of these things, like, wow. Wow. Yeah. Wow. And that's how we can get to the place that we are today, right? Like, you know, I don't see politicians as like all these evil people or whatever, but they're self-interested. And if we don't change the equation on what their self-interests are, which is they can take money from the money class, keep themselves elected, and keep themselves getting elected, excuse me, by feeding people kente cloth meals, you know, nothing's gonna change. You know what I'm saying? And I think that's the point of this podcast, man. I think we wanna, man. I think one day we should do an episode where we round up some of the great works of leftist propaganda and try to share it with the people, man. Because
absolutely,
because this is definitely important. And you know, now I remember I used to, when my girl at dinner parties would like you know, she would joke, not even jokingly, but like just to shock people and to make fun of me. She'd be like, my boyfriend's a communist. And I'd be like, first of all, please stop doing that. But now I'm just like, well, actually, I'm socialist. Like, communism is like something a little bit different, but whatever, you know. And so, you know, this is how you get this way, by just learning about stuff, staying clear-eyed and wanting to stay in the fight, you know. That's our show, man. I want to say a happy holidays to everybody, man, who supports Count the Dings, who listens to this show week after week. We're constantly getting feedback. I get so many people who say this is their favorite show that they listen to, and that, like, they're learning things all the time and they're being hip to stuff. And, man, that's just what we're trying to do. We're trying to share the information, give you guys a perspective that you're not getting out there from your main, your mainstream sources. And so thank everybody who supports us. I hope you guys are safe and with your loved ones this holiday, man. Nando, you wanted to get in there.
No, I mean, I'll echo what you said, that I get more feedback on this show than a lot of the other shows I've been involved with in my life. I've been a host for many, many years. And this show in particular seems to have struck a nerve with a certain audience. And it seems like we're helping people. And that's always what I've wanted to do. Like, I'm not interested in the super advanced, you know, shit or really the bullshit kind of internal debates that happen all the time and in a lot of these kind of left media. I'm just not, that's not what I want to do. I want to get people who are curious, who are interested, who are, you know, just, I don't know, like just regular people kind of going through their day. And I want to just give a little bit of help them with a little bit of political education. And so I just want to say, like, everyone that reaches out, like, I reach out as much as you want. Like, I cannot enjoy it more. And I love doing the show, and I love doing with you guys. And, you know, it's been a tough 2020. We lost Mike, the guy who put us together. And, you know, it's almost like this show is just every week, like a small tribute to him, that we can do, to remember him by. And it's just, you know, it makes me very happy.
Same, man. And so we'll see you guys. No, we will not see you guys next week. Sorry. We'll do a Christmas show, but I think you know enough about me and Nando. Ain't no New Year's Eve show going down, y'all. And so anyway, happy holidays to all you guys again. Reach out to us. Let us know about your political awakenings. We will see you guys in 2021, and hopefully you'll be $2,000 richer by then.
Hell yeah.
And so for Nando Vila, I'm Big Waz, and for Rob Lopez, the producer, we're out of here. Peace.
Out of here.